Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now on this Labor Day weekend is Jeff Biggers, an award-winning historian, journalist, and playwright. He's the author of several books, including The United States of Appalachia, State Out of the Union, and Reckoning at Eagle Creek, and The Trials of a Scald, the founder of the Climate Narrative Project. His latest book is Resistance, Reclaiming an American Tradition. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeff Biggers.
Thanks for having me back, Ian.
And tomorrow, Labor Day, is the beginning of the political season. There's an expectation, that, for example, that the special prosecutor, Robert Mueller, will go silent during this period. I don't know whether that will happen or not. But if the resistance doesn't get its act together and make this blue wave happen, we will have more of Trump. And frankly, we don't know exactly the extent to which the Russians are going to meddle in the elections to help Trump again, as they did in 2016. So here we are, I guess, on the cusp of what has to be a couple of months of serious, sustained resistance.
You know, I think you're precisely right, Ian, and I think it's always been that way. Part of my work is to say, you know, we've gone through these dark periods before in history. And so if we look at the not just sort of random episodes, but the continuum of resistance, you know, I think what I'm saying is how can we learn from that to apply it today? I think precisely what you're saying is true, is that we need to really look at the resistance as giving a backbone now, both to the Democratic Party, but to other means of taking on this administration, both now and with the midterm elections.
But there was a spontaneous manifestation of resistance the day after Trump's inauguration, where millions of women and men as well, but mostly women from around the country and around the world, spontaneously demonstrated. So that was literally right out of the gate, but it wasn't sustained, and it's not sustaining. And here on the, you know, last week we had the 50th anniversary of the Chicago riots at the Democratic Convention. One of the questions I asked the former head of security for the Students for a Democratic Society was, you know, what happened to the anti-war movement that was so powerful the minute that Nixon ended the Vietnam War? It sort of evaporated. It wasn't a sustained movement. So that is one of the things that I detect about the political left in this country. The movements don't tend to be very sustaining. How do you see it?
Well, it's really one of the reasons why I wrote my book on resistance, and I really looked at it as something beyond just protest or electoral politics, but a deeper cultural tradition, but also sort of a deeper cultural duty. You know, Ian, I go back before the American Revolution and look at sort of what were the challenges of the day that made people come together and began to seed a credo that whenever we have duplicitous attacks, you know, on our democracy, on our inalienable rights, our civil rights, how do we come together to confront that? And I kind of walk us through both indigenous movements and American Revolution up till today to see how resistance really is part of a long-term, what we call long-haul approach in our American culture, that we have this fundamental American credo to resist whenever you have this kind of authoritarian spasms and overreach of our rights. And so I think you're right. And part of what I wanted to do as a cultural historian is write a book that kind of rooted the resistance, and especially within the last year or two, and to show that everything that we're fighting against today, we have been fighting for many decades, if not centuries. And then it's part of a long continuum and a long battle, and part of kind of remaining resilient and being sustainable in these kind of movements is to once again realize that we're on the shoulders of many other movements in the past and to not lose hope.
Well, the United States since the Revolution, and of course your book basically lays out a case for the resistance in the age of Trump using the clarion call of the American Revolution, Thomas Paine's Common Sense. But just to add some context before we get into the history that you're relating to the revolution to the current resistance, the United States has never had a president who is a criminal who is possibly controlled by a hostile foreign power. So, I mean, this is not like it. I would say this is a different moment in terms of what we're up against.
Yeah, in that situation, I think you're perfectly right. I think also we've never had an administration in a time of climate change, which we have such irreparable damage happening to our environment. And so I think certainly there are some unique moments right now. But if we look at the past, we can see other moments which were equally as bleak and dark. For example, if we look at the 1790s when John Adams became president, now here's someone who often is considered, you know, the great abolitionist, and one of the great forefathers of our nation, and also one of the main players in our American Revolution. But we forget that once he took power, you know, he had an incredible grasp, a stranglehold, and in fact, insisted being called His Highness and pushed through the Alien Act, which gave him the power to deport anyone he found dangerous, and got the right to the Sedition Act in 1798, which forbade anyone to print, write, or say anything against the president or the U.S. Congress, and a complete shutdown of our First Amendment rights. And so, you know, through history, we have gone through these little dark episodes where you have a president who completely has attempted to have a stranglehold on power, be it, you know, orchestrated from an outside foreign source, like we have today, perhaps, to and internally with, you know, our own kind of aristocracy from the beginnings of our country.
Well, I stand corrected then, Jeff Biggers. President Adams... Donald Trump would want to be like President Adams. He would want to be able to shut down all dissent. Last week he went after Google based upon some lunatic right-wing conspiracy theory. He's fighting algorithms. I often say he's like King Canute fighting the tide, since truth presumably eventually prevails. So, no, obviously we have indeed been through more imperious examples in terms of the presidency. And we're certainly up against it at the moment. And again, I'm speaking on this Labor Day weekend with Jeff Biggers, who's an award-winning historian, journalist, and playwright. He's the author of several books, including The United States of Appalachia, State Out of the Union, and Reckoning at Eagle Creek, and The Trials of a Scald, the founder of the Climate Narrative Project. His latest book is Resistance, Reclaiming an American Tradition. So let's go back to the American Revolution and how you feel that the Thomas Paine, in particular, his famous tract Common Sense, lays the foundation for resistance in the age of Trump.
Sure. You know, Paine, you know, here he comes across the seas in a very late period in 1775, and what I refer to as an undocumented immigrant, someone who barely managed to get on the boat. He's actually sick in his passage. He arrives in Philadelphia on a stretcher because he's so sick. And basically, here's someone who Trump today would consider, you know, someone he'd want to block from immigration, someone who twice had been in debt and been an economic disaster in his own country, had gone through two failed marriages, and who couldn't even make it as a tax collector in England. But Paine wanted to come to our country because of this, you know, burgeoning resistance movement, this independence movement. And when he gets there in Philadelphia in 1775, he's kind of outraged because there's this young movement that's trying to buck the system, these young dock workers, people largely who are African-Americans and natives and Irish immigrants and whatnot, who are trying to deal with the larger merchant class who were very conservative, very afraid of any kind of change and risk, who are very, very much looking at reconciliation. And that's very much in similar to what I find today, that we have a new generation that's emerging. It's quite exciting. That's trying to reframe many of the issues and discussions within the Democratic Party and the nation itself in terms of how we approach our economic politics and our immigration politics and the environment and whatnot. And we need that same kind of resolve, that same kind of backbone that Tom Paine helped manifest. Of course, when he published Common Sense on January 10, 1776, you know, he really galvanized us to push forward and go forward with what we've been talking about. You know, already there was this elite, this aristocracy that was kind of sort of for independence, but who wouldn't come forward. It was Paine who ultimately wrote this incredible publication that sparked this whole movement for the revolution to really take the final step. And of course, 6 months later, we had our Declaration of Independence. We tend to forget that it was Thomas Paine who first published the words United States of America, the person who really saw the future, you know, who said we have it in our power to recreate the world. And he wasn't talking about just replicating the English Constitution, the English system, but for the United States to come up with its own kind of future, its own kind of constitution that represented a nation of immigrants, a nation of indigenous people. And I think that's kind of the resolve and the kind of resistance that we need today. That's much of what I try to do in my book, is to look at not just Thomas Paine, but many people through the abolitionist movement, through the labor movement, through the immigrant rights movement, through the civil rights movement and the environmental protection movement, and especially women and people of color who have played this similar role time after time to help galvanize our spirit in such dark times. But I also go back to look at Paine and many other people in the past who see resistance as an agency of renewal. And I think in particular, for example, last week we had the president once again doing a very devastating decision, announcing the EPA's proposal to roll back the Clean Power Plan, which of course was an 11th hour plan by the Obama administration to put some kind of cap on carbon emissions from power plants. And I think if we look at resistance as more of an agency of renewal, recognizing that 70% of our carbon footprint is coming from cities anyway, it's not something that we nearly need to protest against Trump and protest against these kind of policies and these rollbacks, including more than 70 EPA rules right now that have affected us in terms of the environmental protection. But we need to see the cities and the states, such as California, take a lead role in actually doing climate action, actually moving toward having carbon-neutral cities, like you're seeing now in other parts of the world, moving toward regenerative cities, moving toward places in which we can actually affect change on the ground, be it the environment or civil rights or immigrant rights and sanctuary cities, but effectively through a local or statewide decision. And I feel like that as well is as important resistance to Trump as it is getting into the streets and trying to elect Democrats.
Well, I recently spoke with the country's leading authority on bringing power to major cities. He was head of the TVA, the LA Department of Water and Power, New York Power, the energy czar in California, who saved us from the predations of Enron, Dave Freeman. And in terms of the resistance, or those that are trying to bring about, or at least address the urgency of climate change, he made the point, which I think is important for the resistance to get their act together, in the sense that quite often the battle cry, and Thomas Paine certainly knew how to frame things in a pithy way, in a way, net neutrality, of course, is a terrible term, doesn't tell you anything. Being pro-choice as opposed to pro-life is also not a very good rallying cry. But Dave was saying, we've got to stop using the term climate change, because the climate does change all the time, and use the word climate damage. What do you think of that as a tool of the resistance?
I think that works, but as part of, for example, my work with the Climate Narrative Project, I work with campuses and communities across the country to use the narrative arts to help reframe the whole climate change issue. I think even, you know, looking at solutions-based ideas is also another way of just dealing with it, not even dealing with the devastation, which we're all quite familiar with, but dealing also with some of the solutions. I mean, I've worked a lot with communities. For example, recently I've been working with Gary, Indiana, which is really one of the most devastated urban centers in the country, a place that's completely been depopulated and soaked with contamination of some of the largest steel mills and coal fire plants in the country. And there we've launched this incredible initiative to create what we call a regenerative city, a city that actually begins to produce both the energy and the food and the resources that they consume in a circular economy, in a circular fashion, as opposed to being part of this linear economy and this linear system that essentially has to import everything, you know, both from importing our electricity to importing our food to importing all of our resources that then, you know, turn out to be have an incredibly high carbon expense. And so I think by reframing things in that way as well, both looking at solution-based issues as well as how we can begin the process of not just doing less bad, but actually enhancing our environment and beginning to repair some of the damage is some of the ways we have to go about this. You know, Ian, I talk a lot about Australia, believe it or not, these days. I talk a lot about the city of Adelaide, Australia, which 10 years ago faced a similar situation. And I'll put it in very few words. You had a city here that was completely dependent on coal fire plants, that imported 90% of its food, that found out that it really was reaching a major decision about water and whatnot and air quality. They came together. They met for 90 days. They brought in an incredible thinker named Herbert Girardet from England, who began to get them to think more in a circular fashion, a regenerative fashion. And now Adelaide, 10 years later, has reduced their carbon footprint by nearly 30%, while their economy has also grown by 25%. They've planted 3 million trees. They've created the first solar district, the first solar bus in the world. They've aligned their cities in circles with more than 50,000 acres of local food, which then is brought into the center in these food markets. They've completely refashioned and reframed what the city is all about, and really is one of the leaders now in the city movement in terms of working toward being a carbon neutral city. And that's the kind of thing I think we need to begin to replicate as well in the states in many different areas. And this, to me, is part of the discussion that resistance that we're often leaving out. Mm-hmm. That as we begin to take on or continue to take on Trump in many different arenas, both in the streets, in the courts in terms of immigrant rights, and in the electoral politics with our midterm elections coming up, we also need to begin to walk the walk in terms of actually doing actions locally in our cities. And I think that really ultimately might be the biggest contribution of resistance today.
Resistance becomes regeneration. I thank you very much for joining us, Jeff Biggers.
Thanks so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Jeff Biggers, who's an award-winning historian, journalist, and playwright. He's the author of several books, including The United States of Appalachia, State Out of the Union, and Reckoning at Eagle Creek, and The Trials of a Scold. The founder of the Climate Narrative Project, his latest book is Resistance, Reclaiming an American Tradition. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again with a special Labor Day program. Bye for now.
Time.